My name is Peter Kornbluh. I have come this morning from Washington. Some of you I know, some of you I don't, over the years. I am so grateful for the opportunity to be here. I grew up in Ann Arbor, right up the road. I am very thankful to Kathy for running this space and making this possible and mounting the documents. A special shout out to Ruth Needleman, who spent so many years working on these issues and was there in Chile, which was so very important. Bienvenidos a todos los chilenos que están aquí. Mucho gusto, un gran placer. You know, I'm standing at a podium which has been set up with a telephone and pictures of Nixon and Kissinger. And if you lift this phone, you hear two actors reenacting the phone conversation, the first phone conversation that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger had after the coup. And this document was obtained by my organization, the National Security Archive. It's called a TELCON, which is short for telephone conversation transcript. Because while all of us know that Richard Nixon secretly taped his conversations, very few people know that Henry Kissinger also taped secretly his phone conversations. And so when the two of them were talking on the telephone together, they were actually taping each other without either of them knowing. In Nixon's case, the actual tapes, for the most part, survived. He was going to destroy them, but he got caught in the middle of Watergate with them and couldn't destroy them. After he got caught, it occurred to Kissinger that maybe he better not keep the tapes, and the Kissinger tapes were destroyed. But Henry Kissinger every day had a team of secretaries either listening on his phone calls and transcribing them on a typewriter, or listening to the tapes in the evening or the following day and making these transcriptions. And by the end of the 7 years that he had been National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, there were about 30,000 pages of these transcripts. And a little bit like Donald Trump, Kissinger decided he would take these transcripts for personal gain. They were U.S. government-created documents. Some of them had secret conversations that discussed intelligence matters and classified. And they were certainly historically important. They certainly were the property of the U.S. government. You and I paid those secretaries to create them. But Kissinger put them in a file cabinet that was marked personal papers. And then as he was getting ready to leave office, he had a lawyer in the State Department say that anything that was in a file marked personal papers was personal. And he walked away with a treasure trove of records that he then used to write his memoirs. If you read his three volumes of memoirs, you'll see that he quotes conversations absolutely verbatim. And, you know, when we first at my office read these, we thought, how does he know exactly what was said? And it turns out he knew because he had these transcripts. And we went to the State Department and we went to NARA, the National Archives Record Administration Act, office, and we said to them, you have let Henry Kissinger steal U.S. government property. Here's our lawsuit against you for shirking your duties to secure the property of the American public. And we're about to file this lawsuit in court, in federal court. And the head lawyer at the State Department said, wait, you know, you're right. Let me go talk to Henry. And they went to Kissinger and they said, look, this organization is absolutely correct. The law is on their side. You have taken U.S. government property. You can have this on the front pages of all the newspapers and resist. They didn't know that years later we'd have a president who would do the same thing and would resist. But, or you can return those papers. And he basically said, well, I'll return them, but I want to copy all of them. And so he copied them, and the 30,000 pages went back in 2004 to the U.S. government, and we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all of them. And we ended up getting, you know, I'd say about 90% of them declassified. There's still some phone conversations with CIA directors and intelligence officials and other presidents that we don't have, but we got that document. And I spend a lot of time telling you about the process of getting it because it's a piece of history that's so extraordinary. When the volumes were released to us, the first thing I did is I went to the September 1973 binder and started flipping through it. I started at September 11th, I went to September 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th. And then on the 16th, I found it. The president and Kissinger talking for the first time about the coup in Chile. And this was a priceless document. These two powerful men, both complementing each other for, as Kissinger put it, creating the conditions as best as possible for the coup to take place, and then complaining that the liberal press was, as Kissinger put it, bleeding like a lamb because Allende had been overthrown and had died. And Nixon goes, yeah, isn't that something, that liberal crap. Nobody's going to believe that liberal crap, he says to Kissinger. And then Kissinger responds, yes, Mr. President, in the Eisenhower era, the 1950s, we would be heroes. That's what they wanted, to get the credit, to be treated as heroes because of this great accomplishment of overthrowing Allende. And, you know, we got this document finally released in 2004. That was, 25, 27, almost 31 years after that conversation took place. And it has helped to fill an extraordinarily important hole in history. And before I leave this document, let me just tell you one other element about it. When my book came out, I don't know how many of you are familiar with my book, Kissinger's lawyer, who had also been his top Latin America advisor when he was in office, a man named William Rogers, not to be confused with the other William Rogers, who was Secretary of State. But this William Rogers had been Assistant Secretary for Latin America, and then he'd become Kissinger's lawyer. But Bill Rogers, he decided he would create a team of lawyers to go through the book in advance and kind of tear it apart and try and discredit it. And one of the ways they determined to discredit it is that they invited a very conservative writer and political analyst to come in, and they showed him key documents to try and prove that Kissinger had nothing to do with Chile and that Chile wasn't even important to him. That writer, they wanted to publish his article in Foreign Affairs, the prestigious journal. And Foreign Affairs basically said, yeah, this is very... this is too pro-Kissinger, it's very imbalanced, take it elsewhere. And it ended up appearing in some very conservative magazine, I forget which one. And in it, the argument was that Kissinger had nothing to do with Chile, in part because there were no phone conversations. This guy had been given access to the phone conversations, and there weren't very many about Chile, so this was his argument. So this was a myth that Peter Kornbluh was creating about Kissinger's involvement in Chile. And to prove that the United States had nothing to do with overthrowing Allende and destabilizing the Chilean government and helping General Pinochet to power, he quoted this document, which he had seen only him. It was still secret in Kissinger's possession. So he was the only one. And he says, for example, here's Nixon and Kissinger talking to each other, and this is what they say after the coup. The president says, does our hand show on this one, on the coup? And Kissinger said, well, we didn't do it. That's it. That was the quote in the article. And then a year later, we get the document out, and we find out that the quote goes on. We didn't do it, which is referring to actively being there that day, helping the coup, on the ground, flying the planes, driving the tanks. I mean, we helped them. This part was not in the article. Blank, which is obviously a reference to the CIA or to Richard Helms, created the conditions as great as possible. And that sums up what the U.S. Role was. But so you see the importance. Kissinger set out to distort what the true history was. He allowed this very document to be completely misrepresented. And when we finally got it, we got the fuller history and the truth. And that is what these documents are for. They have passed through a tremendous evolution. Obviously, they were created by the secret agencies and the most powerful men. Almost everybody was a man who wrote these documents at the time, reflecting the imperial mindset of U.S. officials, their belief that might makes right, that if they wanted to change the future of Chile, all they had to do is snap their fingers. The president gives orders to the CIA, and this document, very famous document right here above you, the handwritten notes of CIA Director Richard Helms meeting with President Nixon on September 15th, 1970, and writing down, you know, make the economy scream, best men we have, $10 million more if necessary, we need a game plan in 48 hours, don't tell the State Department that we're doing this. You know, this was the direct authorization of the President of the United States to block the inauguration of the President-elect of Chile. Now, mind you, Salvador Allende had not even set foot in the Moneda Palace to do anything against the United States. He had only been elected, he still wasn't actually president, and already the United States was launching a preemptive strike to stop him from actually being inaugurated. All the other documents, this secret effort to block his inauguration led directly to the assassination of the Chilean commander-in-chief of the armed forces, General René Schneider. We pushed for an operation to take Schneider out because he stood in the way of a coup. He was pro-constitution, and the people under him just didn't want to, couldn't command the troops if he gave other orders, if he said no. So the idea was get rid of him, replace him with a pro-coup general, and everybody would go forward. Allende would be blocked from becoming president. The military would take over. He gets assassinated. I was in Chile in January, just a few months ago. I stood at the very corner where these thugs, who were supposed to be paid with CIA money, $50,000, that the United States sent secretly, the CIA sent secretly to this group of coup plotters. The guns that were going to be used, those were sent as well, disguised as fishing gear in the diplomatic pouch. And whether those guns were used or not, nobody can really say, but they were sent. Life insurance policies. The CIA gave all the assassins life insurance policies before the assassination because they were worried something might happen, their, you know, kids would need to go to college, etc. And then after Schneider was killed, the CIA gave these would-be coup plotters and assassins $35,000 in hush money to help them escape the country, escape justice, escape accountability, and keep them quiet. If that's not U.S. involvement in an assassination of a foreign official, what is? We have the documents here someplace behind you of the CIA headquarters, the director sending a letter of commendation to the station the day after Schneider is shot, saying the CIA station, you all have, you know, are to be commended for your hard work. You've brought Chile to the point where a coup is a possibility. So a record of our involvement. And then we get into the whole Pinochet era and the repression and our knowledge of it and who was committing it. And we now know that you can see his picture over here, Manuel Contreras, the head of the Chilean secret police. He was actually put on the CIA payroll in the summer of 1975 because he was head of the intelligence service in Chile and the closest Chilean official to Pinochet. And the CIA thought, well, what better way to get information about what they're doing than to pay the guy who's literally the most famous repressor and torturer and murderer and international terrorist in the mid-1970s. So these are important documents. They have served so many purposes. We got them. We helped educate the American public and the international community with them. Every time we would get an important document, we'd try and make hay with it. We'd make sure the Progressive did a big story, or the Washington Post, the New York Times. We created a website to start to post these documents. Most of these documents, though, many of them, particularly the ones on the Pinochet era, went to judges and lawyers and even victims' families in Chile to help with legal cases. I had the great honor of having the famous judge, Juan Guzman, introduced my entire book as evidence in his prosecution of Augusto Pinochet. That was one of my great honors. So the documents became kind of evidence in human rights cases. People wanted to sue Henry Kissinger. I personally took the documents relating to Kissinger's knowledge of the Schneider assassination to General Schneider's sons and grandchildren. Yeah. And I said to them, here are the documents. And they hired a lawyer in Washington. They filed a civil suit using the documents against Henry Kissinger for wrongful death. And of course, he had the suit dismissed. Why? Because he is immune from prosecution for tasks and operations and decisions that he undertook in his capacity as a U.S. official. If he had done them in his capacity as a private citizen, yes, well, then he might have been prosecutable. But in his position as a U.S. official, of course, he did make these decisions as National Security Advisor of the President of the United States. The laws of our country protect him, and they penalize his victims and their families. But the suit was written up, all the evidence was compiled, it was all presented in court. And then, you know, the documents started to be used for writing books and writing longer articles. There were many, many documents over the years that came out, you know, close to 30,000 documents on Chile. Students and scholars and book writers started to write about various aspects of this, and the documents became extremely useful for that, and I was very proud, very, very happy of that. And that continues on. By myself, I'm still using the documents. I've just revised this book. This edition was for the 40th anniversary of the coup. Now we're at the 50th anniversary of the coup, and I've revised the book. It's now called Pinochet Desclasificado, and for the first time, there's going to be a Chilean edition coming out in just a few weeks this month, later this month. Which makes me extremely happy. And one of the leading television channels in Chile, Chilevisión, is going to do a four-part documentary about the documents and for the 50th anniversary, and so that's wonderful too. But I'll tell you, my proudest moment was that these documents, quite a bit more of them, became part of a major exhibition at the Museo de Memoria y Derechos Humanos, the Museum of Memory and Human Rights in Santiago, Chile, which, how many of you have been to that museum? Just a few of you. If you ever get to Santiago, you must go to this extraordinary museum. It was built during President Michelle Bachelet's first term as president. It's really a compelling place. And they have a salon, they have a room for a big exhibition hall for temporary exhibits, and they let me mount these documents that are here and probably, I don't know, another 100 more documents besides these in various sizes. They came up with the idea of the telephone that you can listen to. And they had two actors doing in Spanish and English. In Spanish, they had two Chilean actors reenacting the meeting. And there was a beautiful write-up about the exhibit in the New York Times in October of 2017, I believe it was, which I would recommend to everybody. That also was a proud moment for me. The documents had gone through an arc. They started when they were created, obviously. We got them to try and hold U.S. officials accountable for what they did in Chile. We tried to use them. They were used by lawyers and judges in an attempt to prosecute those guilty of these national security crimes, both in the United States and in Chile. And now they were in a museum. And now they're in an art gallery. So, you know, in the end, we didn't get Kissinger prosecuted. That's right. If any of you saw the cover of the Nation magazine, the big picture of Kissinger was titled "Kissinger Still at Large at 100." So yes, somebody said yes. A few people have said to me, you know, still time. Exactly, he's still going strong, actually. But we've used these documents to have stories written about him for his 100th birthday. El País, the very famous newspaper from Spain, which goes all the way around the world. All Spanish speakers seem to read it everywhere, and particularly in Chile. They did a huge story on Kissinger speaking to Augusto Pinochet in a private meeting. I believe that transcript is somewhere on the wall, somewhere here, which you can read the two of them talking to each other. And that generated a big story, and I think Kissinger's reputation was, was hurt by the resurrection of these documents. Because why? It's not Peter Kornbluh saying he did this and that. It's Henry Kissinger's own words. These are documents that he wrote, that he read, or that he said, like this telephone transcript. And in the end, and I'll finish with this, we are left with perhaps not a legal verdict in his case, and not quite a legal accountability in the case of Pinochet either, but we are left with the verdict of history. And, that's not a small thing. It's not what most of us would want and would have hoped for, but it's not a small thing. And I continue to be motivated by making sure those verdicts are spread far and wide, and that they apply to everybody who is involved in the case of Chile, whether it's Augustin Edwards, the owner of El Mercurio, who is the highest level collaborator from Chile with the CIA in the United States, a traitor. And Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and everybody else who was involved. So that's what we're left with, the verdict of history. That brings us, you and me, here today, and I'm so grateful that you're interested and that you've come. So thank you. No, I think Ruth is going to. All right, questions and answers.
Do you have any evidence Nixon may have had conversations with corporations, UFC, the Rockefellers, anything of that sort?
So, interesting you mentioned the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers had a long history in Chile and in Latin America, David Rockefeller in particular. Mm-hmm. And when the richest man in Chile, Augustin Edwards, who owned not only the leading newspaper, El Mercurio, but a whole chain of newspapers and chain of radio stations, he was also the Pepsi bottler in Chile, so he worked with Donald Kendall. But he was friends with David Rockefeller, and it was to David Rockefeller that he first went all the way back in 1969, before Allende was elected, kind of sounding the alarms about the possibility that the left could come to power electorally. And Nixon was not really close or favorable to the Rockefellers. He tended to not like really the kind of Eastern elite very much. But he certainly, David Rockefeller was somebody that could certainly get to him. And his close friend, Donald Kendall, the president of PepsiCo, who was nominally the boss and close friend of Augustin Edwards and had him come to Washington. He came to Washington just literally days after the coup. He met with Kissinger. He met face-to-face with Richard Helms. He spent a week giving the CIA its initial intelligence on potential coup plotters, potential obstacles to a coup. This is all on September 14th and 15th, and when Richard Helms was dragged before the U.S. Senate to testify about these notes, and the orders to Locke Allende, he basically said, well, you know, I think it was because Augustine Edwards was running around with Don Kendall. And when you read the Kissinger transcripts, he's on the phone with Don Kendall. There was also the famous IT&T papers, which actually were leaked during Allende's term in office in 1972 by that famous columnist Jack Anderson. Some of you in the room are old enough to remember Jack Anderson. And there was a disgruntled employee in the IT&T corporate offices, and she started gathering up these documents on memos on IT&T official meetings with the CIA about Chile. She took them home. She put them in her freezer to hide them. And then she gave them to Jack Anderson. And over a period of time, he started writing these columns. And then literally these documents came out, and they were created the first books that we read when we were young about, you know, corporate involvement of intervention in Chile. They actually charted almost 40 meetings with the CIA. Now, we also have Kissinger's telephone conversation transcripts. He gets on the phone with Nixon and says, you know, those IT&T people, they came in, but I told them to go away. You know, so he was not motivated by that, the kind of corporate issue. And the copper companies also, Anaconda and Kennecott, the two biggest companies in the world on copper mining, had huge mines in Chile. They came in, talked to Nixon, talked to Kissinger, but they wanted certain things. They wanted the United States to support the right wing for the election in Chile. And the United States had moved with this whole Alliance for Progress idea to supporting the Christian Democrats, the middle, the centrist parties. And the CIA had focused on the Christian Democrats. And so the U.S. kind of policymakers didn't quite go with those specific recommendations. But the answer to your question is, of course, those corporate officials were in the White House, meeting with everybody, making their opinions known. The most influential was probably Augustine Edwards coming through Don Kendall. And we've obtained, talk about the verdict of history. Anybody can go back and read the major obituaries that were written about Augustine Edwards just a few years ago when he died. And you'll see in the Washington Post and the New York Times, they cite the declassified documents on Edwards' secret meetings with the CIA director, Richard Helms, on the 14th and 15th of September, 1970. I found that memorandum of conversation. Edwards' name was blacked out, but there were other things in the document that made it clear that it was Edwards. And we made sure that everybody in Chile had that actual document, and it was used in the obituaries. So Edwards did not get away with his treachery. On that question, it's hard to say. The United States, the CIA, and the White House had this extraordinary, arrogant, and illogical idea that they could simply have the commander-in-chief of the armed forces murdered and somehow plant propaganda that blamed the left and that everybody would rally against Allende, when, of course, it was obvious that the opposite would be true, that everybody would be in complete shock that their constitutional system was being challenged by who, you know, and would rally in the other direction. So, in fact, the Christian Democrats, who were kind of a question mark about whether they were going to vote to ratify Allende on October 24th, because Allende had not won with a majority vote. He'd won with a plurality of a vote cut into thirds, basically. And he needed to be ratified in order to become president. And that was the target for U.S. strategies, to either bribe those congressmen or disrupt that ratification and keep him from being ratified. And basically, it came down to, we're just going to have a coup, and the military will stop the ratification process from even happening. But in the end, you know, the assassination came, and everybody rallied to support Allende. And the document that's behind me that I just pointed out basically shows an extraordinary argument that Kissinger made. Allende was elected legitimately. There's nothing we can do to say he's not legitimate or to delegitimize him. And there's a real issue here for us we stand for free and fair elections. We go around the world saying that's what we, that's the principle of democracy. If Allende is successful, meaning if he is elected and he starts to redistribute resources, his very experiment at the, you know, peaceful transfer, the peaceful evolution of socialism, other countries, including European countries, God forbid, NATO countries, are going to have leftist coalitions that are going to elect leaders, and they're going to start to do the same thing. And what are we going to be able to do about it? Nothing. So the whole strategic chessboard and our position in it is going to change unless Allende fails. And that's our task, is to make sure he fails. So Allende actually was, you know, there was a lot of mistakes made by his government, and there was a lot of disruption and destabilization by the United States. The last major vote before the coup in March of 1973, Ruth was there, the Popular Unity Coalition won like 47% of the vote. They'd gone up like 5% in popularity. So the policies, in a sense, were working. He was becoming more popular, not less popular, for the positions that he was taking. But at the same time, shortages, turmoil, and, you know, U.S. influence on the Christian Democrats and the right and the military led to the coup. In terms of the question about the State Department, Kissinger wrote this document to Nixon saying, you must take the position that we have to do everything we possibly can to undermine Allende, because the State Department wants to actually have a modus vivendi with him. They think that we can, you know, have U.S. relations with his government for 6 years, and then, you know, he'll lose in 1976. But that's not going to happen, and, you know, and if he's successful, we're in real trouble. So don't pay any attention to the State Department. It was the same with the coup plotting at the very beginning. The U.S. ambassador, who I got to interview when I was a college student at Brandeis, Edward Corey.
Brandeis?
I went to Brandeis, yeah.
I there.
Before you.
Oh.
After you.
After me.
Yeah. I was there in the mid-1970s, and you must have been there in the 60s, right?
I was there in the early 60s.
But in any event, I did track down the former U.S. ambassador, and he told me this incredible story. He came back to Washington to protest what he thought the CIA was doing in Chile. He basically said, trying to foment a coup is not going to work here because nobody wants a coup. I mean, you're creating a coup climate out of whole cloth, and everybody's perfectly fine. You should read all of his cables. Everybody, Chile is tranquil, you know, nobody's upset about this. Allende's been around for a long time. This is like the fourth time he's run for president. Right. So so you just can't create the coup conditions in like 3 weeks. You just can't do that. So he comes back, and Kissinger says to him, "Well, that's very interesting, Mr. Ambassador, but I think you should tell the president himself." So he walks into the Oval Office with Kissinger, and Nixon is in there going like this, "Son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch." And Ambassador Corey says to me, and I thought he was talking about me, and I had this pale look on my face, like, and President Nixon says, "Oh, no, not you, Mr. Ambassador. It's that son of a bitch, Allende. We're going to smash him." And, you know, so, you know, you have different agencies in the U.S. government. They all have different tasks, really. I know that we talk about the U.S. government as kind of a monolithic imperial or imperialist force, but that when you read the actual documents that are generated by all the different agencies, you see that that's completely not the case. A lot of people go into the State Department and they're focused on diplomacy. They're not focused on covert operations. They're focused on diplomacy. We have a document that's not here, which is one of the most appalling documents ever, of Henry Kissinger meeting with Pinochet's foreign minister in February of 1975, at the height of the repression, at the height of the disappearances, at the time when you were being arrested in Chile. And the very first thing Kissinger says, literally the first thing he says to the representative of the pariah dictator and torturer and murderer of Chile, is, "You know, my staff gave me briefing papers for this meeting and it was nothing but human rights." you know, it appears that people who work for me and work in the State Department wanted to go into the ministry, you know, wanted to be priests and nuns, and there wasn't enough room for them in the church, so they came to the State Department. That is literally, I kid you not, in the first 10 seconds of the meeting with Foreign Secretary Carvajal in 1975, absolutely shocking. He's disparaging his own people because they care about human rights and they're trying to get him to make human rights an issue at this meeting. Okay, other questions? You had a question, so we'll get to it.
What about Milton Friedman?
I mean, it is, we're in Chicago. Definitely talk about the Chicago Boys, as they were known in Chile. A whole team, not just Milton Friedman, but a couple of other very prestigious economists and a team of grad students and young economists went to Chile. The Pinochet government paid them. Some of the Chileans who had trained here in Chicago under Friedman were paid by the CIA to write the, what was it called, the BRIC. Do you want to talk about the BRIC?
Yeah, it was the economic plan for Chile. And the idea was to privatize everything, deregulate all of industry, and make all workers contract workers. In other words, it's neoliberalism.
So
but it was also, it was tried in Brazil first, but Chile provided the perfect conditions because Pinochet was willing to kill anybody.
It is absolutely true that the CIA money paid the rent on a building that this institute was set up before the coup with these Friedman disciples to write for the military a plan so that they would have something set for the moment they took over. And of course, a number of the key ministries, economic commercial ministries, were filled by these folks who had studied right here in Chicago almost immediately. And then Friedman got paid to come down and give lectures and make all the arguments for the, you know, the pure free market. So that was, Milton Friedman, he sided with Pinochet, he helped Pinochet. I mean, what can one say?
So that's another connection with Rockefeller.
I mean, I don't see Rockefeller in that mix because Rockefeller wasn't here in Chicago and Rockefeller money wasn't involved in that particular dynamic. Did you have a question over here?
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering also where the women and the pots and pans and all that fit in, how they came into the picture.
So,
who organized them?
This is a beautiful story. Margaret Powers, right?
Yeah, I couldn't read it either. I bought it.
Well, Powers' book is really good, and she's going to, I'm sure, give a very compelling story. Whether she knows this little anecdote about the women and the pots and pans, I'm not sure. It wasn't public knowledge when she first wrote her book. But let me just say, you know, there were significant shortages in Chile. Some of you were there. Some of you know. At the time, there was life became difficult for a lot of middle class people who expected something different, and had something different, and there was a lot of turmoil. And the fact that the pots and pans became a major kind of symbol and expression of protest spreading through cities and then becoming a kind of a form of protest in all sorts of other countries as well, is an interesting, a very interesting phenomenon. But how did this start? It started with about $350 from a CIA agent to a woman who lived in a building near him. And he gave her the money, and she was the first one to start banging the pots and pans. And his name, the CIA officer was a young officer, was his first posting. His name is Jack Devine. He wrote a whole memoir about his career in the CIA with a whole chapter on Chile. And in the chapter on Chile, he tells the story of coming across this this woman who was, you know, raging at him about all the shortages and saying she just was going to, you know, stand out on her balcony and beat her pots, you know, her pans and pots and try and get others. And he said, okay, here. And he gives her money. And she starts to talk to three or four other women in her building. And first you have one building, and then the building next door starts, and then the building after that. And then before you know it, literally at a specific time every night, you've got middle-class women in Chile beating pots and pans and garnering attention from the press till the story kind of went around, right around the world. But then, you know, the idea that this started with a CIA payment is amazing and perfect in a way.
Yeah. $300
$300 or $350, something like that. Which was, you know, a lot more in those days. But if I could address the question, I think that you're asking about the kind of broader issue of the other countries, and the truth is that AFIELD was operating in all those countries as well at that time, part of the Alliance for Progress. Uruguay took a stab at electing a government very similar to the Popular Unity government, and that was thwarted. The U.S. was involved, but Brazil was even more involved. And some of you might be surprised to learn that in Chile, Brazil was even more involved than we were. They had their own strategic interests, but they were also collaborating with Nixon and Kissinger. We did get one of these incredible documents out, and I managed to get it on the front pages of newspapers in Brazil, the United States, and Chile on the same day, which was Nixon talking to the head of the Brazilian junta in December of 1971 and saying, so what's going to happen with Allende? Nixon says to General Medici, what's going to happen with Allende? And Medici says, Allende will suffer the same fate as João Goulart in 1964, and we are working actively to do that. And Nixon responds, well, if there's any support or resources we can discreetly give you to help with that, let me know. Of course, Brazil can do things that we can't. And Brazil did do things that the United States couldn't and was on the ground. Unlike the CIA, which didn't directly participate in the coup, the Brazilians were actually on the ground in Chile the day of the coup and were in the interrogation centers within hours, maybe even the same day as people were being detained and all the foreigners were being rounded up. But here's the point, that this dynamic was going on, the kind of the tug of war between progressive forces and military regimes in the Southern Cone, for starting with Brazil and working all the way through. Eventually, the entire Southern Cone, of course, became a series of brutal military dictatorships, and then one by one, they all collapsed. But the U.S. programs were very similar in all of them. It's just that it was only in Chile where this concept of a progressive coalitions coming to power electorally succeeded at that moment because of the uniqueness of Allende. Just back there. And the answer to that is absolutely yes. There was this amazingly interesting dynamic. You know, Pinochet was arrested in London in October of 1998. I and some colleagues, we went up to the Clinton White House. We said Spain is trying to extradite Pinochet, and they're using the European Convention on Terrorism as a framework for asking that he be arrested in London and extradited to Spain. You should do two things. You should release all the documents so that there's evidence for the case against him, the cases against him of human rights violations. Release all the documents that you have. Why would you want to protect Augusto Pinochet? And the second thing is that you should ask for his extradition. Spain has some large, you know, concept of universal jurisdiction and human rights. You have an act of terrorism right down the street from the White House that he was the intellectual author of. And they took this seriously, both of them. They released 24,000 documents under Clinton. And then they sent Janet Reno to Michelle Bachelet's inauguration, or Lagos' inauguration, I believe it was, to basically say, we're opening an actual FBI Justice Department investigation into Pinochet's role in the Letelier-Moffett assassination in Washington. Just so all you know, the leading opponent of Augusto Pinochet, Allende's former ambassador to Washington, Orlando Letelier, and his colleague at the Institute for Policy Studies, Ronnie Cochran Moffett, were killed by a car bomb that was planted by the Chilean secret police in September of 1976. So what happens? All these documents that they're supposed to release, the ones that we really were looking for was Pinochet's role in the Letelier assassination. But once they opened an FBI investigation into his role, they took all of the documents out of that release as evidence for their investigation, and they did not release those documents. And what happens? They really were serious about this. They wrote up a kind of a proposed indictment. They gave it to Janet Reno. Unfortunately, it was right at the end of the Clinton era. Bush got elected, not Gore. You guys know that history. And it just sits there. The Bush people won't pick up this indictment, they won't pursue it, and it dies. And we have the worst of all worlds. No indictment of Pinochet, and none of the documents that would indict him, as I say, the verdict of history. It was over like 200 documents that were set aside and kept. Years go by. I keep trying to get these documents, and it's very complicated because they come from all sorts of different agencies. And finally, I sit down with the Chilean ambassador, Juan Gabriel Valdez, and I say, you know, the 40th anniversary of the Letelier assassination is coming up. You should just ask the Obama administration, by now it was the Obama administration, to give you those documents. Because there's this whole concept of declassification diplomacy. And they can use those documents as part of a diplomatic gesture to Chile. And at that particular moment, the Obama administration wanted the Chileans to take some of the prisoners in Guantanamo, which Obama had wanted to bring to the United States, and the right-wingers in Congress said no. And so now he was trying to close Guantanamo, but he had to get these prisoners to other countries. He sent six of them to Uruguay, and he wanted to get the Chileans involved. The Chileans said no. But while that dance was going on, the U.S. wanted something from Chile. So if Chile wanted something, which was just like 200 documents that are sitting there, they might get them. And in fact, they were released in kind of mid-2015, most of the 200. And the one that everybody focused on was a memo from George Shultz to Ronald Reagan, which is here someplace, I think, basically saying, the CIA has given me a report on Augusto Pinochet, and they've concluded in this report that Pinochet gave the order to assassinate Orlando Letelier, and then even considered assassinating his own head of the Chilean secret police so that nobody would know that he gave the order. And this guy has blood on his hands, Mr. President. We should consider indicting him ourselves. This is 1987. But if not, we certainly shouldn't support him anymore. So this document made headlines, but it referred to an actual CIA report, which we didn't have. And it took another year to talk the CIA into releasing that report. We had great allies in the State Department, and the State Department officials personally handed a disc to Michelle Bachelet when she was at Sheridan Circle for the 40th anniversary commemoration in 2016. That document, the CIA's own report, which I also think is here on the wall, over right in here someplace, that you can read yourself. The CIA's report in the spring of 1987 saying we have reviewed all of our intelligence cables from 1976 and we have concluded that Augusto Pinochet personally ordered the assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington. Now, again, Pinochet was dead by this time, and he wasn't going to be prosecuted. It's too bad that they didn't try and prosecute him at the time. They could have ended. This is where secrecy and diplomacy and legality and justice just completely collide. We lost the opportunity to have an incredible set of secret documents contribute to ending the dictatorship way back in the mid-1970s, because the CIA didn't want to share the fact that it had intelligence that the guy was an international terrorist. Instead, they focused on, you know, Manuel Contreras and his deputies, and you know, that could have changed the course of the dictatorship. Pinochet stayed in power for another 12 years. Imagine all the people who were killed, all the institutions that were destroyed, etc., because of the secrecy surrounding those intelligence reports. And it took us until 2016 to get that very document that you can read over here. Well, I see the world as very different today than then. And I see Latin American countries as a lot stronger and more independent and more resistant to U.S. influence. And I see U.S. influence waning in the Latin American region, and Chinese influence somewhat growing in the region for a wide variety of reasons. And, you know, you can go back and you can look at the huge scandal that was generated by the revelation that the CIA had been sent to intervene in the democratic elections of another country. It was a huge scandal. It was put the CIA under a light that had never been scrutinized before by the U.S. Senate. The additional scandal of the CIA involvement in assassinations of foreign leaders, including General Schneider, it was added to this. Did U.S. officials learn any lessons? You know, within just 5 or 6 years, Ronald Reagan was sending the CIA in to create the Contras in Nicaragua and overthrow the Sandinista revolution. And we had years and years of scandal and uproar around that operation and the counterinsurgency programs in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. And so, you know, nothing was learned. Very little control was established over the CIA in the aftermath. Perhaps a little more supervision from Congress, but not a whole lot. Today, though, the world is somewhat different, and much of our operations are focused on terrorism issues rather than revolution issues. So I think it's a different setting. We can. I just, you know, since it'll be my last opportunity, thank you all for coming.